I talked to Chomsky about it, mm-hmm. went to America, mm-hmm. and Chomsky was, and he still, I saw him recently, I chaired something he was on about a year ago, and we talked again about it all. He is absolutely without any qualification for Orwell. Orwell told the truth, absolutely. Orwell told the truth. Orwell told it as it was. Nobody has done it as well as Orwell.
Welcome to The Literary Hangover. I'm your host, Matt Leck. With me is Alex Guns.
Hello.
And what you just heard was from the In Our Time podcast on Animal Farm. That was from September 2016. Melvin Bragg talks about how he and he asked Chomsky what he thought about Orwell, and Chomsky's a big Orwell guy, which... I play that because Orwell's probably the one figure for me that I feel that way about still. Mm-hmm. Like, there have been writers who have influenced me quite a ways. I mean, Hitchens is maybe the classic example of a writer who I read a lot and then sort of outgrew a little bit. Orwell's one that I guess, trying to outgrow, because I think that's something you should do with your heroes. But he's by far my go-to, I think, at these moments.
Mm-hmm.
He's my North Star. And the thing about the North Star is it's not actually completely north.
Oh, really?
To the visible eye, there's no star exactly where north, true north is. So we just have to go with the North Star because it's approximate.
So you'd say they're not the most trustworthy.
Well, I'm saying as long as you know the fallibility, it's fairly trustworthy.
I see. Yeah, yeah.
I've used the North Star before.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you're from Iowa. I feel like getting your bearings from the stars is a much more common thing to do in the middle of the country.
Yeah, that's true. I did a lot of like canoeing, but I don't think I ever needed the stars for any kind of guidance.
No, but not guidance, but just general orientation.
Like, yeah.
You see, like, there's Orion's Belt, which is only visible in the winter, mm-hmm. things like that. Anyway, this is too much of a digression on astronomy. Today we are talking about a George Orwell essay called Looking Back on the Spanish War, which was printed in a New Road, I think that's a magazine, in 1943. It's not his first essay on the Spanish Civil War. He wrote Spilling the Spanish Beans in 1937 and Homage to Catalonia in 1938. That's a full-length book. It didn't sell very well at the time, but it's since, I think, gotten respect from a large swath of the left that sort of knows Orwell a bit better because... You know, you have Animal Farm in 1984, which are the very much the dystopian novels. Like, this is a revolution gone wrong.
And they're pretty much required reading, too, right?
Exactly. Homage is a bit more underground, but it's maybe one of the most famous representations of an actual revolution in real life. Orwell says he gets to Barcelona, and it's the first time he's been in a city with the working class in the saddle and a lot of stuff like that. So... but Alex, you wanted to do this essay. Was there, we'll probably get to the specific section later that you thought was relevant, but mm-hmm. is there anything else that you want to say about this?
I was reading through Orwell's essays at the beginning of the year, this year, and I remember just coming across this essay in particular. And I've read Homage to Catalonia and some of his other writings about the Spanish Civil War. And this essay just struck me because it seemed so relevant, and it seemed like an essay that was reaching out to the reader today, because he saw it as like a conscious, the way he frames it, part of the essay, it's like a conscious defining moment where it's like a barrier you have to get through to get to modernity now, that it changed the world psychically so much.
Yeah, I would say it almost set the terms that we're basically fighting now. There's a continuity of eras. Yeah, I think it's definitely right. Like, where the current battle lines you see solidifying in what everyone keeps saying is an increasingly divided country in America, for instance.
Yeah, it provides the opposite of what like the World War II narrative provides, which is World War II provides closure. And it's like pretty, by 41 to the end, it's pretty like one-sided. Mm-hmm. Like, or it's pretty morally non-ambiguous. Whereas the Spanish Civil War, there is no conclusion. It just kind of ekes, the war itself ends, but the conflict just kind of ekes on and then slowly just seeps into modernity, which is kind of where we're at.
Yeah, and to summarize the Spanish Civil War very, very briefly, I think it's 1931. There's sort of a Republican electoral revolution where the sort of Republican left and Democratic left and socialistic left in parts, comes to power, Spanish people vote to have a republic and get rid of the monarchy a few years later, and all during this time, over the course of the early 30s, there are coups being planned and even attempted, and then finally Francisco Franco, a general, comes from Morocco and basically starts an invasion that eventually turns into Franco's dictatorship for like 40 plus years. So, Alex, you wanted to give us a little bit of background into the... There's a huge religious valence to this conflict. It's interesting to untangle a little bit because the Anthony Beaver book, the Battle for Spain, goes into the fact that, you know, it was only about 1 in 5 Spanish people who were weekly churchgoers. So the people themselves weren't as religious as portrayed in the press at the time. But anyway, if you want to set that up for us a little bit.
Spain has a really unique history when it comes to Christendom, and that it was one of the few places that would be considered immune from the Reformation, and that was by design primarily. That we kind of forget now, at least, I don't know, in popular conversation, it's kind of forgotten that for about 400 to 500 years, the Iberian Peninsula, which is now Spain, was largely dominated by the Umayyad Caliphate, which was a Muslim caliphate, obviously. And until about 1000, it's commonly referred to now as Al-Andalus. At that point in history, Al-Andalus would be the most populated, would control the most populated cities in Europe. And you had Jews, Muslims, and Christians essentially living in this metropolitan world. And the Umayyad Caliphate went through Egypt, surrounding the Mediterranean. And they were able to get a number of Roman and Greek codex. And they ended up being like the center of learning around the year like 1000 up to like 11,000 for the most part. Yeah. And they put, so who was there before was like these Visigothic warlords, and they were demolished within 7 years. This is around 711. AD. Right around 1000 to 1100, which is roughly when the Crusades are going on, there's some pushback because the Visigoths have this little teeny wedge on the northernmost part of the Iberian Peninsula, which is now like right by the Pyrenees. Mm-hmm. So over the course of about 400 years, there's this thing that's called the Reconquista, which is this attempt to take over Umayyad Caliphate controlled areas. And eventually the Umayyads are kicked out by the Berbers, but we won't get into that. They actually, by 1249, are able to push Muslim control all the way down to Granada, which is the southernmost point of Iberia, which is borders the Mediterranean. But unfortunately, there's these multiple kingdoms, and it's Castile, Aragon, and Navarre, and they're these Christian kingdoms, and they're constantly fighting with each other. Like, so they're basically, life on the Iberian Peninsula is continuous civil war between these Christian kingdoms. And the central power of the monarch in Castile keeps getting diluted by these nobles and lords. And so eventually in the 15th century, there's this monarch, Henry IV, and he's considered impotent. And he actually has to have his wife artificially inseminated to have a child. And that does happen successfully, but unfortunately word gets out and everyone's like, well, he's not a real king. And that's not a real, a real offspring. And so he has a half sister who's Isabella of Castile. And the nobles pick her because she's 20 at the time. And they're like, well, we'll back her in this. We'll foment civil war and back her. And then we can control her. Unfortunately for them, it turned out Isabella was an autocratic lunatic. I can't remember who said it, but there's some famous phrase, I think maybe from England, where it's like the worst thing, the most dangerous thing on earth is a king who actually thinks that they're a king. Like that they're here to do God's work.
Oh, right.
And so Isabella was a big fan of Joan of Arc, and she was going to unite Spain.
Oh, dear.
So she actually ended up uniting Spain by marrying the king of Aragon, Ferdinand. And so they unite Spain that way. And then through her big thing is she wants to start a war on crime, that she thinks that crime is too rampant in the Spanish kingdoms.
I wonder if that was that racialized at all, that war?
Not yet. It becomes racialized because the Christians are too lax, basically, that her impotent brother was allowing anyone to get away with anything from rape to not going to church on Sundays, which were equally bad.
Right, yeah, totally.
So eventually she invades, she finally collapses these different Christian kingdoms, and that is essentially what becomes Spain, but there's still this Muslim outpost, which is the Emirate of Granada. In 1482, so she's crowned in 1474 and consolidates these multiple Christian kingdoms. In 1482, she invades Granada. after an 8-month siege at the Alhambra, finally kicks out the last of the Muslim rulers and creates what is now Spain. Now, through that, there's another program that she creates with that, which is the Inquisition, which is what we all know. She said, because there happened to be a lot of Jews living in this Muslim area, and she absolutely could not tolerate that. So she either said, you either have to leave. So it was forced deportation of what we think is now probably 800,000 people to
Jesus.
Yeah, to Portugal and to northern Africa. And then you either, or if you didn't want to leave, you had to publicly convert to Christianity, which is kind of like now, like, be a citizen or get out.
Right. We're just civic nationalists.
Yeah, exactly. And it was actually a very gendered thing, because it was all based, like, they would go after conversios, which is like people who said they converted a long time ago, that they used to be Jewish, now they're Christian. But the way they would target these people is like based on accusations on their dietary planning. Because, like, oh, well, really, you're a Jew. So really, the one of the forgotten things about the Inquisition is it actually targeted women primarily, because it was about how you would dealt and prepared food in the kitchen. Anyway, so they're able to expel all the Jews. The Pope is actually kind of freaking out about it. He's like, you're going way too far. And she's like, well, I'm the monarch of this. Like, I'm the one who says, like, what's going to happen in my country. I'm more Catholic than you, basically. And then eventually, like, well, we should kick out all the Muslims, but there's even more Muslims than Jews. And she's like, I don't know if that's possible. But the church was just like, well, we're just going to start doing it, and basically start forcing converting. And then they eventually did expel all the Muslims as well. Mm. So in that moment when the handover happens at the Alhambra Palace, Christopher Columbus is there. He witnessed it, because that was January 1492. Oh. And she's the one who funds his expedition to what eventually is the Americas. But his whole thing is like, I'm so inspired by you, Isabella. I would like to go around the world to the Holy Land and reclaim it for you.
Right.
So that's if you want to know where the discovery of the Americas came from, it came from that cultural milieu for the most part.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So, and then the other aspect of Spanish culture that I want to touch on is the sort of radical anarchist side of it. Anthony Beaver's book, which actually, The Battle for Spain, I wasn't prepared to take much from it, I guess, the first time, because the second time through, I think it's a really great book. Here's a good section on the anarchism of the sort of how that came to Spain, as opposed to sort of the Marxist sorts of socialism.
The first attempt to organize some form of trade union in Spain had occurred as early as the 1830s, and there were small non-political associations in existence at the middle of the 19th century. Then new political ideas arrived across the Pyrenees and began to take root. The anarchist or libertarian form of socialism arrived first, and its fundamental disagreement with Marxist socialism was to have great repercussions in Spain. Proudhon had already been translated by P.E. Marcal, the president of the First Republic, when Giuseppe Fanelli arrived in Spain in 1868. Fanelli was an admirer of Bakunin, Marx's great opponent in the First International. He came to Madrid without speaking any Spanish and with no money, but the idea, as it became known, found a very enthusiastic audience. Within 4 years, there were nearly 50,000 Bakunists in Spain, of whom the majority were in Andalusia. There were several reasons why anarchism in the early days became the largest force within the Spanish working class. Its proposed structure of cooperative communities, associating freely, corresponded to deep-rooted traditions of mutual aid, and the Federalist organization appealed to anti-centralist feelings. It also offered a strong moral alternative to a corrupt political system and hypocritical church. Many observers had pointed to the naive optimism which anarchism inspired among the landless peasants of Andalusia. Much has also been made of the way in which the word was spread by ascetic, almost saint-like characters, and how the converts gave up tobacco, alcohol, and infidelity while rejecting official marriage. As a result, it was often described as a secular religion. Even so, the intensity of this early anarchism led converts to believe that everybody else must see that freedom and mutual aid were the only foundation of a naturally ordered society. An uprising was all that was needed to open people's eyes, unfetter the vast potential of goodwill, and set off what Bakunin called the spontaneous creativity of the masses. Their frustration at being unable to unlock the mechanism of history, as the Russian writer Victor Serge described it, led to individual acts of political violence in the 1890s. The Tigres Solitarios, as their fellow anarchists called them, acted either in the hope of stirring up others to emulate them, or in reprisal for the indiscriminate brutality of the Brigada Social, the secret police. The most famous example was the torturing to death in 1892 of several anarchists in the castle of Montjuic in Barcelona. This led to an international outcry and to the assassination of Cánovas del Castillo, the organizer of the restoration. A vicious circle of repression and revenge was to follow. During the last quarter of the 19th century, the Marxist wing of socialism, los autoritarios, as their opponents called them, developed much less rapidly. In late 1871, Karl Marx's son-in-law, Paul Lafargue, arrived after the fall of the Paris Commune, and within a year the basis of Spanish socialism was laid in Madrid. The Marxists' comparative lack of success was partly due to the emphasis which they placed on the central state. The socialists, under Pablo Iglesias, a typesetter who emerged as the leading Spanish Marxist, proceeded cautiously and concentrated on building an organization. Eventually, in 1879, they founded the Spanish Socialist Workers' Party, PSOE, and formed their General Union of Labour, UGT, in 1888. Iglesias still insisted that the class struggle should be waged in a moderate and evolutionary manner. The PSOE did not formally repudiate the monarchy until 1914. The socialists accused their anarchist rivals of irresponsibility, but they in turn were seen as heavily bureaucratic and received the nickname of Spanish Prussians.
Yeah, so that sort of gives you the background between the sort of anarchist versus socialist or communist split.
I mean, I know it's like the Freddie Simpson's heads out there. It's like the cliche to be like, X place is a land of contrasts. But
right, yeah.
But really, it really compared to other countries in the European mainland, Spain really is a unique place when it comes to not just different cultures, but massive swaths of different cultures that have to live right next to each other. And in some cases, it's actually extremely successful. Mm-hmm. And then in some cases, that can be weaponized and it becomes some of the worst, like the worst European brutality is in that very like Iberian Peninsula.
Yeah, it's weird. It's almost like a early or like a type of America. Like you have the Catalonia stuff, you have the Andalusia, which just to place those, like Catalonia will be up by the Pyrenees, the northeastern mm-hmm. portion of it. Andalusia is the part with like the great or Strait of Gibraltar, the southern tip of it. Let's move a little bit to Orwell's part in all of this. Orwell, during all this time, is writing. He writes a few books. He's about ready to publish one called The Road to Wigan Pier about his time in sort of a mining town in England, and talks about sort of like the class. And so it's a very good book to read, actually, if you're a socialist. And that's published by a guy named Victor Galanz, who runs a left-wing book club. And he's trying to get that published. There's already some sort of infighting on the left, so there's some politics going on there.
Shocking.
And this sort of goes into, and as this is happening, Orwell wants to go fight in the Spanish Civil War, because at this point, it's not seen as like a outside of Spain, it's viewed in the through the press as simply democracy versus fascism. More revolutionary elements of it, where they're building or trying to form a class of society in parts of Spain, is hushed up because at the time, basically, the dynamic, and we'll get into this a little bit more, is but you don't want to scare away the French and the British because they have a bunch of people who like the property system as it is. So you just want this to be against the scary fascists who are against democracy.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The popular understanding for at least the first year internationally was that there's no chance that the fascists could win. Also, I thought it was that it was such a like a fringe possibility that everyone kind of like one of the reasons that was people were slow, like the left was slow to get involved because they just thought, well, there's no way.
It's possible, although the like Mussolini and Hitler were in there right away.
Yeah, I think
at
that
least, yeah.
I thought that the is it Bevor, is that how you say his last name? Yeah, I think his book kind of outlined that there was just like the popular consensus was that it was hard to imagine, even though that Hitler and Mussolini were moving at a rapid pace.
Yeah, and then but ultimately what happens is Franco is kicking ass until and the Republican / socialist which I basically mean not anarchist government can't match up to Franco. It's basically the anarchists, workers, who are able to give Franco his first defeat. And so here's where Orwell goes to Spain. This is Orwell by Michael Sheldon.
As Galanz well knew, his author was in no position to give a timely response. When the book was published, Orwell, whom Galanz rebukes for failing to recognize the proper way to defeat fascism, was in a muddy trench on a remote hilltop in Spain, dodging sniper fire from a fascist army. 2. When Orwell went to Spain, he was not certain that he would fight. He lacked neither courage nor conviction, but he doubted whether he had the stamina or the skill to be a good soldier. And because of the chronic weakness of his lungs, he suspected that he would be turned down for health reasons if he tried to enlist. But he did not rule out joining one of the Spanish political militias if it became clear that they could use him. In the meantime, he decided that the best way to serve the cause was to observe the war and write about it for the New Statesman or for some other English paper that was sympathetic to the Republican government. He'd been told that he would not be permitted to enter Spain without some supporting documents from a British left-wing organization. As he learned later, this warning was inaccurate, but he did not want to take the chance that he would be turned away at the frontier. So he sought the assistance of the one left-wing organization in London whose name would mean something even to the most backward Spanish border guard. He went to the British Communist Party and managed to put his request directly to its chief, Harry Pollitt. He and Pollitt had never met, but Pollitt seems to have taken an immediate dislike to him. He must have smelled the blood of a right-wing deviationist when Orwell walked into his office, because he began to question him carefully and soon concluded that his visitor was politically unreliable. He refused to help him and ended their interview. It was a distinctly unpleasant meeting, and Pollitt's memory of it may have caused him to launch his highly personal attack on Orwell 3 months later in his Daily Worker review of The Road to Wigan Pier. Not only did he dismiss the writer as a disillusioned middle-class boy, but he also ridiculed him for daring to speak out on a subject that he does not understand. After Pollitt's hostile reception of him, Orwell telephoned the headquarters of the Independent Labour Party, and its officials readily agreed to help him. He was given a letter of introduction to the ILP's Barcelona representative, John McNair. With this matter settled, he was ready to set off for Spain. After saying goodbye to Eileen, he began his journey, travelling first to Paris, where he paid a brief visit to Henry Miller, who told him that the idea of going to Spain was sheer stupidity. "Why get involved in someone else's fight?" Miller asked. In 1940, Orwell recalled their meeting and the forcible way in which Miller had advocated the merits of selfishness and political indifference.
So that's a little bit of Orwell leading and how he got to Spain. I think it's interesting. He tries to be a communist to get over there, and they're like, no, there's something off about Orwell.
I wonder if it's just because there's another essay about, you know, his experience in boarding school, and I wonder if he can't shed that kind of pedigree that you wouldn't normally associate with like a communist radical. That's people who are like in the resistance see him, and it's like, you seem more like a dandy, if anything.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder how much of it is based on like Orwell's not, he's not a member of the British Communist Party. He's a member of the Independent Labour Party. So it's like he's never part of the main teams, whatever. He's too, I guess, contrarian for that sort of thing. But that's why he ends up sort of with the Trotskyists.
It is kind of mysterious that he did decide he was radical, and he was radicalized enough to go fight in a different country's war, essentially.
Yeah, I think he liked to do things. I mean, a brief summary of Orwell's life is he finishes sort of, I guess, the British equivalent of high school. Doesn't go to Oxford or Cambridge, but goes to basically be a policeman in the British Raj in India. That's his early 20s. He comes back and he writes a few books and a couple novels, all very preoccupied with sort of class and work and money and stuff like that. One of them's Down and Out in Paris and London. He works as like a dishwasher and sort of goes as a tramp through those cities. He likes to get amongst it, basically. That is like the Greatest Generation thing, right? Like, you just go for it.
It's hard not to read him as a deeply moral figure, especially people that we've been reading that I think we kind of like. You can relish in like a certain like a writer's flaws, kind of, because it is, you know, it's interesting and relatable, and it's what makes him complex. Whereas Orwell sometimes does kind of come off as like a paragon of virtue that you almost can't. You can't break through to find like the human Orwell.
Yeah. So I suppose let's actually get to this essay, this looking back on the Spanish War. Now, like I said, this is the third time he's written about Spain. Now, patreon.com/literary hangover, because we're going to start a new series just for patrons that is basically going through Orwell essays called Orweller. They might be, they probably will be released later on. Oh, you got, what is that?
This is all of them.
Wow.
This is what made me want to read it. This, there's a Modern Library, or no, sorry, Everyman's Library has an excellent collection of every single essay and like any article that he wrote.
Oh, it's about,
it's about, it's a little over 1,300 pages, but I read it in this winter and it was a blast.
Yeah. So I have an ebook called 50 Essays from Orwell, which you can get on the Australian Project Gutenberg.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that there was in different hemispheres.
Yeah, there's different for that stuff. Orwell's the best. So we're going to be doing a lot more Orwell essays, but just for premium patron subscribers at first. So patreon.com/literaryhangover. If you're not there, if you are, you're going to get some more content. So yeah, so this is looking back on the Spanish War. The first one he wrote, Spilling the Spanish Beans, which was in 1937, is very much aimed at sort of the, so basically Orwell gets over there and works for this militia called the PUM, which is, they're called the Trotskyist Party, but Trotsky himself was at odds with them. So like, this is how you get with the left, I guess.
Oh man.
And I'm not entirely sure what distinguishes the Trotskyists from the anarchists in this, except like they like Marx and the anarchists are suspicious of Marx, I mm-hmm. guess. Maybe there's something more to that if you know @LitHangover on Twitter. But the Trotskyists and the anarchists want to continue the revolution. They want to keep expropriating private property from the oligarchy and the church and those sorts of groups. Whereas the sort of Republican/Democratic/Socialistic/Communists who are in government and liberals, they want to pause the revolution for a little bit and all have a united front against fascism and actually Spilling the Spanish Beans. Orwell calls, like, goes off on that. So if you want more on that, check it out there. The only people who are willing to give guns to Spain are Mexico and Russia. And even then, it's not that much. But just because the USSR is one of the great powers to give guns, they get influence. And ultimately, they not only pause the revolution, but try to turn or successfully turn a lot of the gains made by the revolution back. And Orwell dislikes that. So Orwell's critique of Stalin originally comes from the left of Stalin, that Stalin's is counter-revolutionary. So actually, let's go in. And this was all portrayed massively cynically in the press. And a lot of the beginning of this essay is Orwell taking a stab at sort of press complicity or misinformation.
Looking back on the Spanish War. First of all, the physical memories, the sounds, the smells, and the surfaces of things. It is curious that more vividly than anything that came afterwards in the Spanish War, I remember the week of so-called training that we received before being sent to the front. The huge cavalry barracks in Barcelona with its drafty stables and cobbled yards. The icy cold of the pump where one washed. The filthy meals made tolerable by pannikins of wine. The trousered militia women chopping firewood. And the roll call in the early mornings where my prosaic English name made a sort of comic interlude among the resounding Spanish ones.
So the first part of this essay is Orwell sort of putting you in the location. And mm-hmm. you get the sights and smells, the latrine and everything like that. And he's doing that to set up the readers for a critique of how the media reacted to the Spanish War, especially on the left. He says, like, of course you can criticize the right, but that goes almost without saying.
Yeah, like, assume it's a given.
Yeah.
The bomb is a bomb, even though the cause you are fighting for happens to be just. Why is it worthwhile to point out anything so obvious? Because the bulk of the British and American intelligentsia were manifestly unaware of it then and are now. Our memories are short nowadays. But look back a bit, dig out the files of New Masses or the Daily Worker, and just have a look at the romantic warmongering muck that our left-wingers were spilling at that time. All the stale old phrases, and the unimaginative callousness of it, the sang-froid with which London faced the bombing of Madrid. Here I am not bothering about the counter-propagandists of the right, the Luns, Garvins, et hoc genus. They go without saying. But here were the very people who for 20 years had hooted and jeered at the glory of war, at atrocity stories, at patriotism, even at physical courage. If there was one thing that the British intelligentsia were committed to, it was the debunking version of war. The theory that war is all corpses and latrines and never leads to any good result. Well, the same people who in 1933 sniggered pityingly if you said that in certain circumstances you would fight for your country, in 1937 were denouncing you as a Trotsky fascist if you suggested that the stories in New Masses about freshly wounded men clamouring to get back into the fighting might be exaggerated. And the left intelligentsia made their swing over from war is hell to war is glorious, not only with no sense of incongruity, but almost without any intervening stage.
That's very classic Orwell.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Like, I don't know. I don't even know how to describe it. You probably can better because you know him better. But it's like, you know, comparing him to Hitchens is like something Hitchens would have welcomed, I think.
Yeah,
but,
Hitchens' wishes.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that as far as put downs go, Hitchens is so much more like verbose and so much more like inflammatory. Whereas Orwell, he's so demolishing, but in such like a curt, polite manner.
Yeah.
Not curt, soft, polite manner.
Yeah. Hitchens is more like grenades.
Yeah.
And Orwell, like, he's not without Orwell. When he goes after somebody, he can really go after him. He goes after Auden.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, it says, like, so much of the left is like, Auden says the phrase necessary murder in a poem, and Orwell says, personally, I would not speak so lightly of murder. To me, murder is something to be avoided. So it is to any ordinary person. The Hitlers and Stalins find murder necessary, but they don't advertise their callousness, and they don't speak of it as murder. It is liquidation, elimination, or some other soothing phrase. Mr. Auden's brand of amoralism is only possible if you are the kind of person who is always somewhere else when the trigger is pulled.
I mean, yeah, it's tough when you're being called up by a guy who is shot in the throat by a fascist.
Yeah, Auden replied, I was not excusing totalitarian crimes, but only trying to say what surely every decent person thinks if he finds himself unable to adopt the absolute pacifist, blah, 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 whatever. I think it is pretty much established. I think Adam Hochschild in his book gets into Auden basically being like, he was only shown what they wanted him to see. He was sort of like the naive writer brought in to propagandize.
Yeah, there's that big controversy where he kept platforming Ezra Pound after he had been jailed for treason because he was doing radio broadcasts for Mussolini to try to demoralize the Allied troops. And Auden was like, listen, like, does he say that in the poem? But the thing is, like, one of them was like usura about like international usury. So it's like, yes, in the poem, he was being a fascist.
Right. Yeah. So here's Orwell again going in on some newspaper men.
In 1935, shouted for a firm line against Germany in 1937. Supported the People's Convention in 1940, and are demanding a second front now. As far as the mass of the people go, the extraordinary swings of opinion which occur nowadays, the emotions which can be turned on and off like a tap, are the result of newspaper and radio hypnosis. In the intelligentsia, I should say they result rather from money and mere physical safety. At a given moment, they may be pro-war or anti-war, but in either case, they have no realistic picture of war in their minds. When they enthused over the Spanish War, they knew, of course, that people were being killed, and that to be killed is unpleasant. But they did feel that for a soldier in the Spanish Republican Army, the experience of war was somehow not degrading. Somehow, the latrines stank less. Discipline was less irksome. You have only to glance at the New Statesman to see that they believe that. Exactly similar blah is being written about the Red Army at this moment. We have become too civilized to grasp the obvious. For the truth is very simple. To survive, you often have to fight. And to fight, you have to dirty yourself. War is evil, and it is often the lesser evil. Those who take the sword perish by the sword, and those who don't take the sword perish by smelly diseases. The fact that such a platitude is worth writing down shows what the years of rentier capitalism have done to us.
There's a feminist critique of Orwell, which is that he puts this sort of these sort of liberations always in a sort of martial context, and therefore sort of masculine, right? Like his in Homage to Catalonia, it talks about how the face of an Italian militiaman, a young militiaman, is sort of, that's the future of, you know, for people in Europe.
Yeah.
And I think that is an interesting critique, because it is all like, you know, it is writing about what you know, right? He was a policeman in India, colonial policeman in India. He fought in fascists in the Spanish Civil War, and he was a member of the BBC during World War II.
You can see that he never fully sheds that kind of policeman on the beat point of view. And sometimes it comes to help, and then sometimes you can see him, it simplifies his prose a little bit, but the idea that there is this kind of like bestial nature in mankind that you're a fool to ignore, then the more refined you get, the more you forget that the majority of everyday reality is based on material things.
2. In connection with what I've just said, a footnote on atrocities. I have little direct evidence about the atrocities in the Spanish Civil War. I know that some were committed by the Republicans, and far more, they're still continuing, by the fascists. But what impressed me then, and has impressed me ever since, is that atrocities are believed in or disbelieved in solely on grounds of political predilection. Everyone believes in the atrocities of the enemy and disbelieves in those of his own side, without ever bothering to examine the evidence. Recently, I drew up a table of atrocities during the period between 1918 and the present. There was never a year when atrocities were not occurring somewhere or other, and there was hardly a single case when the left and the right believed in the same stories simultaneously. And stranger yet, at any moment the situation can suddenly reverse itself, and yesterday's proved to the hilt atrocity story can become a ridiculous lie, merely because the political landscape has changed. In the present war, we are in the curious situation that our atrocity campaign was done largely before the war started, and done mostly by the left, the people who normally pride themselves on their incredulity. In the same period, the right, the atrocity mongers of 1914 to 18, were gazing at Nazi Germany and flatly refusing to see any evil in it. Then as soon as war broke out, it was the pro-Nazis of yesterday who were repeating horror stories, while the anti-Nazis suddenly found themselves doubting whether the Gestapo really existed. Nor was this solely the result of the Russo-German Pact. It was partly because before the war, the left had wrongly believed that Britain and Germany would never fight, and were therefore able to be anti-German and anti-British simultaneously. Partly also because official war propaganda, with its disgusting hypocrisy and self-righteousness, always tends to make thinking people sympathize with the enemy. Part of the price we paid for the systematic lying of 1914 to 18 was the exaggerated pro-German reaction which followed. During the years 1918 to 1933, you were hooted at in left-wing circles if you suggested that Germany bore even a fraction of responsibility for the war. In all the denunciations of Versailles I listened to during those years, I don't think I ever once heard the question, what would have happened if Germany had won? Even mentioned, let alone discussed. So also with atrocities. The truth, it is felt, becomes untruth when your enemy utters it. Recently I noticed that the very people who swallowed any and every horror story about the Japanese in Nanking in 1937 refused to believe exactly the same stories about Hong Kong in 1942. There was even a tendency to feel that the Nanking atrocities had become, as it were, retrospectively untrue because the British government now drew attention to them. But unfortunately, the truth about atrocities is far worse than that they are lied about and made into propaganda. The truth is that they happen. The fact often adduced as a reason for skepticism, that the same horror stories come up in war after war, merely makes it rather more likely that these stories are true. Evidently, they are widespread fantasies, and war provides an opportunity of putting them into practice. Also, although it has ceased to be fashionable,
before we get to that part, which I really like, this essay it is very timely because we are all freaking out about this whole fake news. How can we can't agree on what's real anymore? And I guess the point is, like, this is not anything new at all.
Yeah. I think that's what stuck out the most when I was reading that essay, is it finally someone correctly diagnosed the symptoms of modernity for me. That's like, yes, this is the world that I feel like I'm living in.
Exactly.
Or there can be no statement of fact that isn't, like, it doesn't have 1,000 different points of view behind it, that it's like, well, if you say that, then you must say this.
Yeah, and wasn't produced by power. And
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sorry. But like, I think of that with, like, you know, the current ethnic cleansing that is happening in this country.
Right.
And it's absolutely impossible to grab on to anything. Everything melts into thin air when you try to be like, okay, there are people in concentration camps currently.
Right.
It's like, that's got to be, for people who would consider themselves like a moral person or whatever, like, that's it. Yeah. Like, it's got to be it. But it's like, it's the conversation spins out of like, that's not really happening, or it's,
we need that,
that's already been happening for a very long time. And it's like, well, no, it hasn't. But even if it has, who cares? Like,
right. And also it's sort of like, well, yeah, we have the people in the camps, but we just need everybody to come together for common sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, immigration reform. It's like, no, we need to stop being fucking Nazis.
Yeah, it's like crackpot logic, which is like, well, how do we come together on this? Like, you cannot, like, yeah, morally.
and just to underline that point, Orwell does not do both sides when it comes to atrocities. Here he is.
Rather more likely that these stories are true. Evidently, they're widespread fantasies, and war provides an opportunity of putting them into practice. Also, although it has ceased to be fashionable to say so, there is little question that what one may roughly call the whites commit far more and worse atrocities than the reds.
Reds being the sort of like radical reformers, whites being the sort of property and powerful classes, basically.
And that comes from the white army, right, in Russia during the Civil War after the revolution?
I think so, yeah.
There is not the slightest doubt, for instance, about the behavior of the Japanese in China. Nor is there much doubt about the long tail of fascist outrages during the last 10 years in Europe. The volume of testimony is enormous, and a respectable proportion of it comes from the German press and radio. These things really happened. That is the thing to keep one's eye on. They happened even though Lord Halifax said they happened. The raping and butchering in Chinese cities, the tortures in the cellars of the Gestapo, the elderly Jewish professors flung into cesspools, the machine gunning of refugees along the Spanish roads. They all happened, and they did not happen any the less because the Daily Telegraph has suddenly found out about them when it is 5 years too late.
It's always just very wry.
Yeah. I think just very casually punctures a hole into, like, the concept of progress, which I think is so important to just about everyone,
right?
That we are getting better primarily through technological achievement. He's like, basically like, no, it's a disaster. Yeah. Like, modernity is a disaster for the average person.
Yeah. Orwell is also a very good at, he was on board with the techno skepticism. Like, technology is not going to save you folks. Don't expect it to.
And yeah, if I can do one quick side note with the way he talks about the press, you know, opinions changing from day to day. There's a corollary I really like, which is the printing press being invented in 1440 was hailed as this like ability to liberate mankind from like from power, because it's like you can educate yourself and you can you can be your own master. But what happens is the first printing press shows up in Spain in 1474, which is the exact year that Isabella of Castile is inaugurated or crowned as queen. And she's like, this is great. And she's the only person in Spain her whole life that has a printing press. And so there's these courtiers who record the life of like what's happening in court. But those things would usually come out in 10-year intervals, basically. And this is what, you know, the king was doing at X time. And it's like this romantic way of propagandizing the king. But now Isabella's like, oh, we can release this daily. So she's like, she hired multiple courtiers to record what she was doing, and she's like, whoever can make it more extravagant I'll pay more. So all of a sudden there's this for the first time in European history, there's this rapid propaganda machine for made on this thing that's supposed to liberate mankind.
Weird.
And she's using it as a way to be like, I can actually and she would, there was two things she would like, she would want printed, like would to elevate her as almost to godlike status, and any kind of information you could find on Jews or Muslims that are make them horrible, like make sure that the people know about
of course,
that,
right.
Because it's horrible. It's horrible what they're doing.
Oh man. I mean, good thing that never happened with any other sort of communications technology.
Yeah, yeah.
Good thing like the sort of radio,
social media, Twitter.
Yeah. Well, like in Our Time for the Spanish Civil War, it's a good episode of In Our Time. They talk about like there's a rural urban divide in Spain, and there's a lot of new technologies like radio and the people feeling left behind. It's like, oh boy. Oh yeah, and just in case you think Orwell's biased because he was fighting the fascists, to say that fascist violence or right wing violence is typically worse than left wing violence, it is just true, and it's something that if you feel the need to play both sides of it over, you're not actually being wise; you're being a sucker. And
such a fine line.
Yeah, Anthony Beevor, who's a mainstream historian, concurs with what Orwell says. Here's what he said. And it's interesting because the worst atrocities were also perpetrated by the sort of revolutionaries or socialists or Republicans, whoever, against the clergy. And those were also the most publicized because the church has a good propaganda organ.
Yeah. And a good network, you could say.
Yeah, exactly. So everybody heard about it. Like if a priest got killed... To me, those sorts of killings aren't, generally speaking, it's because like there's a collapse in the state, and so there's like some random killings. But on the right wing side of things, the government, it's still systematic. They're in charge of everything. It's not like it's more of a policy than random acts of violence.
Carlist Requetes making a Republican lie in the form of a cross before hacking off his limbs to the cry of "Long live Christ the King." If people in other countries were reminded of the 30 Years' War or the religious persecutions of the Dark Ages and shuddered at this new barbarism, it was not surprising. The slaughter did not follow the same pattern on each side. In nationalist territory, the relentless purging of Reds and atheists was to continue for years, while in Republican territory, the worst of the violence was mainly a sudden and quickly spent reaction of suppressed fear, exacerbated by desires of revenge for the past. The attacks on the clergy were bound to cause the greatest stir abroad, where there was little understanding of the church's powerful political role. The Catholic Church was the bulwark of the country's conservative forces, the foundation of what the right defined as Spanish civilization. Not surprisingly, the outside world had a fixed impression of Spain as a deeply religious country. The jest of the Basque philosopher Unamuno that in Spain even atheists were Catholic was taken seriously. Centuries of fanatical superstition enforced by the Inquisition had engraved this image on European minds. Even so, it was surprising how few foreign newspapers made the connection between the religious repression dating back to the Middle Ages and the violent anti-clericalism that developed in the 19th century. The rage which led to such excesses in some areas was fired by one great conviction. The promise of heaven for the meek was the age-old trick by the rich and powerful to make the poor accept their lot on earth.
Yeah, and elsewhere he says basically the church is seen by workers and radicals as the sort of psychological operations wing of the state.
Yeah.
I just think like that is important to stress because that's one of the reasons I admire Orwell so well is like he doesn't come out of this saying, you know, atrocities on both sides is fine, very fine people on both sides of it. And like, no, there's right and wrong here. And sometimes chickens come home to roost. Nobody should die in violence, but fundamentally, like what the church was doing to the Spanish people in general was like long-term violence.
Yeah, and I think it's impossible to ignore. Although actually, it's ignored quite well currently, but it's impossible in this context. If you're looking at it seriously, to ignore the fact that at this moment in time, the Catholic Church is fully intertwined with Mussolini's fascist program.
Right.
The Vatican, where the Pope currently resides, is a minor state that was built exclusively by Mussolini to buy them off, to essentially help publish his fascist propaganda at pulpits all over the world, which they did knowingly.
So now we're going to skip a little bit ahead. We're going to skip some very interesting parts, and I'll link to this full essay. The parts we're going to skip, there's one that's kind of famous where it's him deciding not to shoot at a fascist who realizes he's making a break for it with his pants halfway up, and he has to pull his hold his pants up, and he's like, a person holding his pants up and running isn't a fascist. They're visibly a human being like yourself. A bit soft on fascism there. Or
what? Yeah.
And then there's another part where there's a Spaniard who probably Orwell dare says he has some Arab blood in him. He's darker skinned, and Orwell talks about how when he found something missing, a person immediately accused this kid of being the thief and strip searched him, and the kid was very, very embarrassed. But Orwell says ultimately he was innocent, but nonetheless let himself get searched with a sort of like resignation that really affected Orwell. Well, Orwell was, I think, fairly good on color or on race prejudice. He'd be one of those guys who's like, because he was a cop in India, and I think that scarred him. He writes about it in a way that it does affect him a lot. And so he's pretty good in it, but we're going to skip over that a little bit.
Well, it shows how unique of a person Orwell is, that becoming a cop is what radicalized him.
Right, exactly, yeah. Here is more of what the sort of like psyops and disinformation and, you know, power politics.
Could you feel friendly towards somebody and stick up for him in a quarrel? After you had been ignominiously searched in his presence for property you were supposed to have stolen from him? No, you couldn't. But you might, if you had both been through some emotionally widening experience. That is one of the byproducts of revolution. Though in this case it was only the beginnings of a revolution and obviously foredoomed to failure. 4. The struggle for power between the Spanish Republican parties is an unhappy, far-off thing which I have no wish to revise at this date. I only mention it in order to say, believe nothing or next to nothing of what you read about internal affairs on the government side. It is all, from what source, party propaganda, that is to say, lies. The broad truth about the war is simple enough. The Spanish bourgeoisie saw their chance of crushing the labor movement and took it, aided by the Nazis and by the forces of reaction all over the world. It is doubtful whether more than that will ever be established. I remember saying once to Arthur Koestler, history stopped in 1936, at which he nodded in immediate understanding. We were both thinking of totalitarianism in general, but more particularly of the Spanish Civil War. Early in life, I had noticed that no event is ever correctly reported in a newspaper, but in Spain, for the first time, I saw newspaper reports which did not bear any relation to the facts, not even the relationship which is implied in an ordinary lie. I saw great battles reported where there had been no fighting, and complete silence where hundreds of men had been killed. I saw troops who had fought bravely denounced as cowards and traitors, and others who had shot fired hailed as the heroes of imaginary victories.
It's messed up on your recording, too.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, it was who hadn't fired a shot hailed as victors, too.
And I saw newspapers in London retailing these lies, and eager intellectuals building emotional superstructures over events that had never happened. I saw, in fact, history being written not in terms of what happened, but of what ought to have happened according to various party lines. Yet, in a way, horrible as all this was, it was unimportant. It concerned secondary issues, namely the struggle for power between the Comintern and the Spanish left-wing parties, and the efforts of the Russian government to prevent revolution in Spain. But the broad picture of the war which the Spanish government presented to the world was not untruthful. The main issues were what it said they were, but as for the fascists and their backers, how could they come even as near to the truth as that? How could they possibly mention their real aims? Their version of the war was pure fantasy, and in the circumstances it could not have been otherwise. The only propaganda line open to the Nazis and fascists was to represent themselves as Christian patriots saving Spain from a Russian dictatorship. This involved pretending that life in government Spain was just one long massacre. Vide the Catholic Herald or the Daily Mail. But these were child's play compared with the continental fascist press. And it involved immensely exaggerating the scale of Russian intervention. Out of the huge pyramid of lies which the Catholic and reactionary press all over the world built up, let me take just one point. The presence in Spain of a Russian army. Devout Franco partisans all believed in this. Estimates of its strength went as high as 500,000. Now, there was no Russian army in Spain. There may have been a handful of airmen and other technicians, a few hundred at the most, but an army there was not.
That was right, too.
Some thousands of foreigners who fought in Spain, not to mention millions of Spaniards, were witnesses of this. Well, their testimony impression at all upon the Franco propagandists, not one of whom had set foot in government Spain. Simultaneously, these people refused utterly to admit the fact of German or Italian intervention, at the same time as the German and Italian press were openly boasting about the exploits of their legionaries. I have chosen to mention only one point, but in fact the whole of fascist propaganda about the war was on this level. This kind of thing is frightening to me because it often gives me the feeling that the very concept of objective truth is fading out of the world. After all, the chances are that those lies, or at any rate similar lies, will pass into history. How will the history of the Spanish War be written? If Franco remains in power, his nominees will write history books and, to stick to my chosen point, that Russian army which never existed will become historical fact, and schoolchildren will learn about it generations hence. But suppose fascism is finally defeated and some kind of democratic government restored in Spain in the fairly future. Even then, how is the history of the war to be written? What kind of records will Franco have left behind him? Suppose even that the records kept on the government side are recoverable. Even so, how is a true history of the war to be written? For, as I have pointed out already, the government also dealt extensively in lies. From the anti-fascist angle, one could write a broadly truthful history of the war, but it would be a partisan history, unreliable on every minor point. Yet, after all, some kind of history will be written, and after those who actually remember the war are dead, it will be universally accepted. So for all practical purposes, the lie will have become truth. I know it is a fashion to say that most of recorded history is lies anyway. I am willing to believe that history is for the most part inaccurate and biased. But what is peculiar to our own age is the abandonment of the idea that history could be truthfully written. In the past, people deliberately lied, or they unconsciously coloured what they wrote, or they strove to the truth, well knowing that they must make many mistakes. But in each case, they believed that the facts existed and were more or less discoverable. And in practice, there was always a considerable body of fact which would have been agreed to by almost everyone. If you look up the history of the last war in, for instance, the Encyclopedia Britannica, you will find that a respectable amount of the material is drawn from German sources. A British and a German historian would disagree deeply on many things, even on fundamentals. But there would still be that body of, as it were, neutral fact on which neither would seriously challenge the other. It is just this common basis of agreement, with its implication that human beings are all one species of animal, that totalitarianism destroys. Nazi theory indeed specifically denies that such a thing as the truth exists. There is, for instance, no such thing as science. There is only German science, Jewish science, etc. The implied objective of this line of thought is a nightmare world in which the leader, or some ruling clique, controls not only the future, but the past. If the leader says of such and such an event, it never happened, well, it never happened. If he says that 2 and 2 are 5, well, 2 and 2 are 5.
If you've read 1984, you'll recognize that as coming into play.
Yeah, you can see some germs in there. Yeah.
This prospect frightens me much more than bombs, and after our experiences of the last few years, that is not a frivolous statement. But is it perhaps childish or morbid to terrify oneself with visions of a totalitarian future? Before writing off the totalitarian world as a nightmare that can't come true, just remember that in 1925, the world of today would have seemed a nightmare that couldn't come true. Against that shifting, phantasmagoric world in which black may be white tomorrow, and yesterday's weather can be changed by decree, there are in reality only two safeguards. One is that, however much you deny the truth goes on, as it were, behind your back. And you consequently can't violate it in ways that impair military efficiency. The other is that so long as some parts of the earth remain unconquered, the liberal tradition can be kept alive. Let fascism, or possibly even a combination of several fascisms, conquer the whole world, and those two conditions no longer exist. We in England underrate the danger of this kind of thing, because our traditions and our past security have given us a sentimental belief that it all comes right in the end, and the thing you most fear never really happens. Nourished for hundreds of years on a literature in which right invariably triumphs in the last chapter, we believe half instinctively that evil always defeats itself in the long run. Pacifism, for instance, is founded largely on this belief. Don't resist evil, and it will somehow destroy itself. But why should it? What evidence is there that it does? And what instance is there of a modern industrialized state collapse unless conquered from the outside by military force?
Oh, yeah. So this is at the end of In Our Time, the Spanish Civil War. This episode is, I think, from a while ago. Yeah, April 3rd, 2003.
Yeah.
But I think it's they kind of get to something. And I think Orwell would be maybe relieved that this is the state of the historiography of the Spanish Civil War at this point.
What's happened since 1975? There's this business of healing and closure and that sort of stuff. Has that
Franco left in the in 1970?
That been going on?
Well, not since 1975. I think, in a sense, the deal of the negotiated transition, which came in after Franco's death in the latter part of the 1970s, was basically that a veil of silence would be drawn over, in a sense, what had happened. That on the one hand, there would be an amnesty for anti-Francoists, judicial amnesty, but on the other hand, no one would talk about what the regime had done to Spaniards in the long years of its incumbency.
Still less than trial for it.
Truth and Reconciliation Commission either, which is, you know, separate from judicial retribution. But in a sense, the left had the civic humanitarianism to buy that during the transition, because it was the least worst of the options. Because if you think about the firepower of the army, the pro-coup tendencies in the army in the late 1970s, and the vast amount of firepower, the number of phalangists of the single state party who still had weapons in their possession. So the idea of a redescent into civil war, in a sense, made that kind of deal, that pact of silence, perhaps inevitable.
And not just the real possibility, at least, of violence, if not of an outright civil war, but also, I think, a genuine, deep desire on the part of many ordinary Spaniards not to revisit what had happened in the past, not to open up old wounds.
And yet that had a tremendous cost, because...
An enormous cost, which is coming out now as the mood in Spain is changing.
How's it coming out now?
Well, the mood in Spain is changing, particularly, I think, of amongst younger generations who are more removed, and so, who want to know what happens, which is why, as Paul mentioned, there are these groups of archaeologists and forensic scientists excavating bone pits.
There's also a biological imperative here, that there is this generation that experienced this thing is actually passing. And I do think there's a very real connection with the whole phenomenon of Holocaust memory here. These terrible memories need to be put in the public domain, that we need to have public remembrance so that you can then pass on from them.
Which is a cultural mood as well. I mean, that doesn't only affect Spain. I mean, it's very, very marked, not just in history, but in popular culture and public culture as well.
I mean, fortunately, although there has been, I agree with everything that's been said, there has been this pact of silence. Historians didn't accept it, and there's been huge, and thank God, because obviously most of the people who were there are now dying off if they're not already dead. But there's been fantastic work done by local historians, and I think that historians since 1975, right across Spain, have actually fulfilled, you know, Walter Benjamin's injunction to historians to speak for the dead, and I think they've done that.
There's been a lot of oral history, or the collecting of evidence, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, vast amounts. And I mean, sometimes the books are quite tedious because effectively they're lists
oral
of names.
Oral history often is, but it doesn't put it being invaluable.
Absolutely.
No, indeed, absolutely. Yeah. And in a real sense, they're war memorials.
Yeah. Yes, war they are. And, yeah, and to people who never had war memorials, who were given any...
Yeah, so I thought that was a very apposite conversation based on Orwell's anxieties. And I think he was right that, I mean, my general take is he was right that we were entering an incredible dark time for transparency of power.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know about, well, not to get into the Kennedy assassinations, but all sorts of different assassinations that just the American government was exporting and supporting across the world. And like, and we were far from the only great power doing shit like that. And I think we're basically like on the other end of that, where I do think the internet presents a challenge for that sort of operation. I don't think it necessarily is one that's going to deliver us socialism, but it is a problem that I think that's why you see, I guess, more desperate or more blatant disinformation, and that's why I think that we have Trump, is because like you need to jam more of the channel than you used to.
Yeah, I think so. There's something, I don't know, primordial about the Spanish Civil War in the same way that the French Revolution is, where you can see it. If once you know about it, you see it in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's so miraculous about the Orwell essay, is he grabs onto the primordial nature of the Spanish Civil War, and to say that the conflict that's happening through violence is a conflict that the average person in modernity is living through every single day. And I feel like I can see it. Like, I can see the world he's talking about. He's talking about the Spanish Civil War, but he might as well be talking about 2019.
Yeah.
And that's what, I don't know, it's he's like a prophet in the way that he's not talking about the future, but he's talking about things that are always true.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like the struggle, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We'll fast forward a little, just slightly here. Also, readers of 1984 will recognize Orwell's faith in the proletarians and the workers. Also gets an airing in this essay here.
The backbone of the resistance against Franco was the Spanish working class, especially the urban trade union members. In the long run, it is important to remember that it is only in the long run, the working class remains the most reliable enemy of fascism, simply because the working class stands to gain most by a decent reconstruction of society. Unlike other classes or categories, it can't be permanently bribed. To say this is not to idealize the working class. In the long struggle that has followed the Russian Revolution, it is the manual workers who have been defeated, and it is impossible not to feel that it was their own fault. Time after time, in country after country, the organized working class movements have been crushed by open, illegal violence, and their comrades abroad, linked to them in theoretical solidarity, have simply looked on and done nothing.
Still got to work on that.
And underneath this secret cause of many betrayals has lain the fact that between white and colored workers there is not even lip service to solidarity.
The white working class and intersectionality conversation, Orwell already on that.
To them in theoretical solidarity have simply looked on and done nothing. And underneath this secret cause of many betrayals has lain the fact that between white and colored workers there is not even lip service to solidarity. Who can believe in the class-conscious international proletariat after the events of the past 10 years? To the British working class, the massacre of their comrades in Vienna, Berlin, Madrid, or wherever it might be, seemed less interesting and less important than yesterday's football match. Yet this does not alter the fact that the working class will go on struggling against fascism after the others have caved in. One feature of the Nazi conquest of France was the astonishing defections among the intelligentsia, including some of the left-wing political intelligentsia. The intelligentsia are the people who squeal loudest against fascism, and yet a respectable proportion of them collapse into defeatism when the pinch comes. They are far-sighted enough to see the odds against them, and moreover, they can be bribed, for it is evident that the Nazis think it worthwhile to bribe intellectuals. With the working class, it is the other way about. Too ignorant to see through the trick that is being played on them, they easily swallow the promises of fascism. yet sooner or later they always take up the struggle again. They must do so because in their own bodies they always discover that the promises of fascism cannot be fulfilled. To win over the working class permanently, the fascists would have to raise the general standard of living, which they are unable and probably unwilling to do.
Now, that part, I think, is super relevant to dealing with the Republican fascists that are currently controlling the government.
Yeah.
The big anxiety when Trump won is, oh, shit, what if he destroys the Democratic Party by doing this sort of populist, health care? We're not going to leave anybody on health care.
Like and deal for white people.
Yeah, and we're going to do a bunch of infrastructure spending in white states, mainly.
Yeah, yeah.
And they can't do that because they fundamentally can't put that money out there.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they might be forced to do something like that off the back foot, but they can't take the initiative because the party is too corrupt and too greedy.
Yeah.
And I think that's true of fascism. I think that's basically been proven true of fascism throughout
time. Well, I think it was interesting when near the end of the election, after the election, when Trump is elected, Paul Ryan's critique of the Republican Party was that they were so used to being a minority party that they forgot what it's like to run in, and be in charge. But it's like, yeah, of course, like you only know how to like a far right party would only know how to critique the life of the working class. Like that's not a smart or even, I wouldn't say that out loud if I were Paul Ryan, because basically it's like, yeah, you're a Nazi propagandizer is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, you have no constructive agenda.
Yeah, like we can't solve what the world that we built.
It's been a decade and there's no semblance of what a Republican healthcare plan might look like.
They
don't give a fuck at all. There's also no Republican climate change plan. Republican climate change plan is to ask liberals why they aren't pushing for nuclear energy enough. Yeah. Like that's all it is. Or to wank off about natural gas or something, or carbon capture, which, by the way, just a quick aside, if carbon capture was coming down the pipe, it would have happened by now. That's just my estimate. Fossil fuel companies would have figured that shit out if it was scalable, but anyway.
Win over the working class permanently, the fascists would have to raise the general standard of living, which they are unable and probably unwilling to do. The struggle of the working class is like the growth of a plant. The plant is blind and stupid, but it knows enough to keep pushing upwards towards the light, and it will do this in the face of endless discouragements. What are the workers struggling for? Simply for the decent life, which they are more and more aware is now technically possible. Their consciousness of this aim ebbs and flows. In Spain, for a while, people were acting consciously, moving towards a goal which they wanted to reach and believed they could reach. It accounted for the curiously buoyant feeling that life in government Spain had during the early months of the war. The common people knew in their bones that the Republic was their friend, and Franco was their enemy. They knew that they were in the right, because they were fighting for something which the world owed them and was able to give them. One has to remember this to see the Spanish War in its true perspective. When one thinks of the cruelty, squalor, and futility of war, and in this particular case of the intrigues, the persecutions, the lies, and the misunderstandings, there is always the temptation to say, one side is as bad as the other. I am neutral.
Here we go.
In practice, however, one cannot be neutral, and there is hardly such a thing as a war in which it makes no difference who wins. Nearly always one side stands more or less for progress, the other side more or less for reaction. The hatred which the Spanish Republic excited in millionaires, dukes, cardinals, playboys, blimps, and whatnot, would in itself be enough to show one how the land lay.
Hell yeah.
In essence, it was a class war. If it had been won, the cause of the common people everywhere would have been strengthened. It was lost, and the dividend drawers all over the world rubbed their hands. That was the real issue. All else was froth on its surface.
I love that section. Yeah. I remember coming across that during the run-up to the 2016 election and arguing with people about, is there a difference between Trump and the Republicans and Hillary and the Democrats?
Right.
And fuck yes, there's a difference between that. Like, Hillary and the Democrats, they're bad. They are bad. They continue to be bad to this day. The Democratic Party is awful. It is better than the Republican Party.
Yeah.
You want to keep... power out of the fascist hands as much as possible.
And I think that it ties into Orwell's thesis about, like, there's no truth anymore, in the way that, like, sometimes you hear those kind of comments and it's like, you do know that the ability to distinguish objects or ideas from each other is what makes you human. Mm. And if you cannot distinguish a difference between two things, like from bad and less bad, then you're negating your human responsibility of cognizance.
Right. And it's really just, to me, it's such a transparent attempt to get to a stasis point.
Yeah.
Like, if you can cancel out both sides, you don't have to move a iota.
Yeah.
And it's just cowardice to me. It's cowardice masquerading as wisdom and contemplated, conclusions.
Yeah. It's good not to trust any movement whose terminus point is where they started from.
Right. Now we'll move on a little bit to where Orwell analyzes the geopolitical calculations of it.
The outcome of the Spanish War was settled in London, Paris, Rome, Berlin. At any rate, not in Spain. After the summer of 1937, those with eyes in their heads realized that the government could not win the war, unless there were some profound change in the international setup. And in deciding to fight on, Negrin and the others may have been partly influenced by the expectation that the World War, which actually broke out in 1939, was coming in 1938. The much-publicized disunity on the government side was not a main cause of defeat. The government militias were hurriedly raised, ill-armed and unimaginative in their military outlook. But they would have been the same if complete political agreement had existed from the start. At the outbreak of war, the average Spanish factory worker did not even know how to fire a rifle. There had never been universal conscription in Spain. And the traditional pacifism of the left was a great handicap. The thousands of foreigners who served in Spain made good infantry, but there were very few experts of any kind among them. The Trotskyist thesis that the war could have been won if the revolution had not been sabotaged was probably false.
Orwell implies that strategy in his earlier writings. He's since come around a little bit.
Thesis that the war could have been won if the revolution had not been sabotaged was probably false. To nationalize factories, demolish churches, and issue revolutionary manifestos would not have made the armies more efficient. The fascists won because they were the stronger. They had modern arms and the others hadn't. No political strategy could offset that. The most baffling thing in the Spanish War was the behavior of the great powers. The war was actually won for Franco by the Germans and Italians, whose motives were obvious enough. The motives of France and Britain are less easy to understand. In 1936, it was clear to everyone that if Britain would only help the Spanish government, even to the extent of a few million pounds worth of arms, Franco would collapse and German strategy would be severely dislocated. By that time, one did not need to be a clairvoyant to foresee that war between Britain and Germany was coming. One could even foretell, within a year or two, when it would come. Yet in the most mean, cowardly, hypocritical way, the British ruling class did all they could to hand Spain over to Franco and the Nazis. Why? Because they were pro-fascist, was the obvious answer. Undoubtedly they were, and yet when it came to the final showdown, they chose to stand up to Germany. It is still very uncertain what plan they acted on in backing Franco, and they may have had no clear plan at all. Whether the British ruling class are wicked or merely stupid is one of the most difficult questions of our time, and at certain moments a very important question. As to the Russians, their motives in the Spanish War are completely inscrutable.
Before we get there, do you have anything you want to say about that?
I don't know. I don't know if I have much. It's just another example of Orwell just cutting right, almost like a sniper.
Right.
Just like putting Britain in his crosshairs and just being like, why would they do this? Like probably because they're pro-fascist. How about that? And this is written in 1943, right?
Right.
So the height of World War II.
Yeah, yeah.
To be like, yeah, they actually, guess what? Like, they were backed into joining the fight against the Nazis. How about that? Like,
yeah, it's a great mix of the sort of vulgar Marxist take.
Uh-huh.
But also, he realizes there's something more to it then. Like, right, like, yeah, they were pro-fascist, but they ultimately were against the fascist powers, right?
Yeah.
They ultimately recognize it as a threat, even though they chose it over. Like, he's the best parser of the sort of great power motives.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think that section is as impressive to me as any sort of essay writing, political essay writing. I'll put this in here because I want to know other writers we should follow their essay work. If anybody has suggestions of people who got their time as well as Orwell did, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I think he describes a world that I think after World War II really flattened the ambiguities of the run up to this like global conflict,
right?
Where it's like we always knew they were bad, and we were just like waiting for the time to strike. I think it's pretty much the narrative at this point. Yeah. And Orwell is pointing out a world where it's like a state is going to act in a way that it perceives that its power can most be utilized.
Right, exactly.
And sometimes that's going to be aligning with things that could be very destructive for the average human being. And that's like the nature of a state currently.
Right. Here is more from this In Our Time with a Paul Preston talks about the British role and if they could have done something.
But it's sort of, I can't not ask it at the moment, Paul Preston. If the British had intervened more positively, as did Italy, Germany, Portugal, and Soviet Union, do you think it would have changed not only the war there, but 20th century?
Totally. I mean, I happen to think that Germany and Italy are in it because they want to weaken Britain and France. They see it as an operation to change the balance of power. And basically, the only person one of the very few people in the British ruling classes who sees this is Churchill, who effectively says that what happens is that the British let their class interests overcome their strategic interests. And the fact is that what happens in the Spanish Civil War is that Britain and France are strategically weakened at the expense of Germany and Italy. And I genuinely believe, I mean, as a historian, I shouldn't even go there. I shouldn't get into counterfactual speculation. But I do believe, I mean, I'll give you one little bit of proof for what it's worth. There's a meeting in Rome in the first week of January of 1937. Goering goes to Rome and talks to Mussolini, and he says to him something like, "We've got 3 weeks. We've got to get Franco to win in the next 3 weeks because there is no way the British are not going to wake up and stop us." Mm. And of course, the British don't wake up and they don't stop them. But had they done so, had they been stronger in opposition, then I think that the whole course of events, you know, the Anschluss, Munich, I think the whole thing would have been dramatically different. I mean, you know, if you push me, I'd end up saying there probably wouldn't have been a Second World War.
That's going to have to stay there, otherwise we're going to be here all day on that.
Yeah, so that's an interesting little hypothetical there.
Mm-hmm. And Inner Time is such like an excellent broadcast, probably my favorite podcast, I think.
Yeah.
And usually that's one of the few times where the commentator's like, "I'm going for it." Like,
right, yeah.
With an opinion, like, you know what, like, I know I'm not supposed to do this, but... Mask off.
I need to look into Paul Preston a bit more. I did like his performance in that. So let's go a little bit. You know, the Spanish Civil War really is the moment where bourgeois democracy fucked everybody for the 20th century. Like America and the UK failed. They and FDR. Like this is on FDR. There's a portion in the Hochschild book where somebody's trying to lobby FDR to support the Republicans with arms, and he's like, "I can't hear you," and so he repeats himself louder, and he's like, "No, what I mean is I can hear the Catholic lobby and like the oil lobby here way louder than I can hear you," which is annoying because you had like fucking Hemingway, you had like popular, like the press was all there.
The Lincoln Brigade was there, which was right. This unofficial group of Americans that had volunteered to fight for the left.
Yeah. And ultimately, FDR isn't able to support them. But the American who is able to support a side in the war is the Texaco, the head of Texaco. And I wasn't going to play this, but I think we need to go into it. Let's see here.
His novels, histories.
It's from Adam Hochschild.
In Madrid, nationalist troops plus units of their German and Italian allies marched through the city in a victory parade, while warplanes were arrayed in formation to spell out "Viva Franco" in the sky. The exodus of refugees, mostly on foot, grew to 500,000. "Lifting our hearts to God," said a telegram of congratulations to Franco from Pope Pius XII. "We give sincere thanks with your excellency for the victory of Catholic Spain." Doubtless also thankful was Torkild Reber, who knew that Texaco would at last be fully paid for all the oil he had supplied on credit. In total, Reber sold the Nationalists at least $20 million worth of oil during the Civil War, the equivalent, by the most conservative calculation, of some $325 million today. Texaco's tankers made 225 trips to Spain, and ships the company chartered another 156. A grateful Franco continued to buy Texaco oil long after the war, and later made Reber a Knight of the Grand Cross of Isabella the Catholic, one of Spain's highest honors. Although the American press had ignored
Yeah, that's her. That's the same Isabella.
Oh, nice.
Texaco's oil lifeline, the Nationalists knew how essential it had been. After the war, the Franco government's oil monopoly publicly acknowledged the enthusiasm shown for our cause by Reber and Brewster, and the way Texaco had offered its assistance without reservations of any kind. A few years later, the undersecretary of the Spanish Foreign Ministry went further. "Without American petroleum and American trucks and American credits," he told a journalist, "we could never have won the Civil War."
And I've also seen a number. Basically, Texaco gave, on credit, the fascists twice the amount of oil that the Republican side had for the entire war.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thanks, America.
Which is, I mean, that's such proof that it's way beyond business at that point.
Oh, definitely.
That's 100% ideological. In a way that liberals, for whatever reason, could not be.
They can't do it.
Yeah, I don't know why they can't pull the trigger on that kind of
pussies.
Stuff.
Pussies. Oh, my God. If I had $1 billion at the time of the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah, yeah. Make a mech suit and just go
Yeah,
over.
Exactly. We would have had, like, the H-bomb, like, 2 decades earlier, basically.
But yeah, I remember reading, like, some Spanish Civil War right back-to-back with Weimar Germany, and just... It's just like reading, there's a number of different countries, like then the interim period between World War One and World War Two, and you're just like, good Lord, like liberals are not good at self-preservation.
No, they fuck us. So here is a bit more on Stalin's part of it.
Questions of our time, and at certain moments a very important question. As to the Russians, their motives in the Spanish War are completely inscrutable. Did they, as the Pinks believed, intervene in Spain in order to defend democracy and thwart the Nazis? Then why did they intervene on such a niggardly scale and finally leave Spain in the lurch? Or did they, as the Catholics maintained, intervene in order to foster revolution in Spain? Then why did they do all in their power to crush revolutionary movements, defend private property and hand power to the middle classes against the working class? Or did they, as the Trotskyists suggested, intervene simply in order to prevent a Spanish Revolution? Then why not have backed Franco? Indeed, their actions are most easily explained if one assumes that they were acting on several contradictory motives. I believe that in the future we shall come to feel that Stalin's foreign policy, instead of being so diabolically clever as it is claimed to be, has been merely opportunistic and stupid. But at any rate, the
Yeah, that's like that. I remember reading that a few years ago and thinking like, oh, this is kind of actually a year or so ago during the Russia stuff, and thinking you people are getting a bit, you know, Putin sucks. Putin might have blown up citizens of his in an apartment complex. He might do some terrible stuff, but he's not this like master of the universe.
Yeah, it's I don't know how you can watch the last couple of years and assume that people in power have this like hyper level of competency.
No.
That I don't know. People seem to attribute with government heads being like, well, you know, they're playing 12D chess or whatever.
Yeah. 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 I wish, I mean, if anything, Obama should have got that out of the heads of liberals for a while. Cause like, he's like doing things that people could at every point people could say, oh, this Merrick Garland thing is just give him a chance to let the full strategy play out.
Well, the full strategy is always, at least like in the Obama years, is like, just wait until just wait until the Republicans look like complete fools at the end of this.
Yeah, exactly. Eventually they'll be shamed into acting like, they don't want to kill us all. I'm just going to play a little bit from Anthony Beaver on the Battle for Spain on Stalin's motives here.
Hiral's request for arms received no reply. For the first 2 weeks of the Spanish Civil War, the lack of comment on events from Moscow raised alarm in foreign communist circles. Stalin was about to purge the Red Army, Trotsky's creation, and he was deeply concerned at the prospect of a foreign adventure which might provoke Hitler at such a time of Soviet weakness. But the exiled Trotsky made use of this silence to accuse Stalin of betraying the Spanish Revolution and aiding the fascists. Whether or not it was Trotsky who goaded him into action, Stalin must have realized that Soviet communism would lose all credibility and probably the loyalty of European parties if nothing was done to help the Republic. Stalin therefore decided to send aid to the Spanish government, but little more than the necessary minimum. In this way, he would neither frighten the British government, which he needed as a potential ally, nor provoke the Germans. On the 3rd of August, popular demonstrations and spontaneous indignation meetings took place all over Russia. Factory workers made voluntary contributions to help the Republic, and the government sent its first non-military supplies. Comintern officials, using false names, were also sent to Spain to make sure that the young Spanish Communist Party should not step out of line. Only at the end of September did Stalin decide to provide military help. The first shipment left the Crimea on the 26th of September and did not reach Cartagena until the 4th of October.
I think that's interesting how Trotsky sort of like goads Stalin into being like, hey, I thought you were the head of the communist country in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you going to maybe do something here? I got to say, I'm very much new to a lot of the Stalin, Trotsky drama. I haven't sunk a lot of time into trying to parse it out, but like Trotsky always seems to come out on the good side of all this stuff.
Yeah, I think so. I've got to be either the same or slightly behind where you are. The idea of someone calling himself a Trotskyist now seems like it's still kind of like alien to me.
It's weird that like I still see it used as an insult in the way that really pissed off Orwell in not only Looking Back in the Spanish Civil War, but more explicitly in Spilling the Spanish Beans.
Yeah. A trot.
Yeah, you're a trot. And like, it always seems very hard to define outside of very historical situations.
Yeah.
Where it doesn't seem like being a trot is that bad of a thing. Like Orwell too, like says in, I think in Homage to Catalonia, that he understood the idea that you would stop the revolutionary activity and fight the fight. Uh-huh. His problem was when you started rolling it back, the revolutionary gains. And that just seems like the right, like that seems like the perfect synthesis position to have.
Almost. Yeah.
Now we've got one final section, and this is really Orwell at his best here. You mentioned this Italian militiaman he saw on the front when he just arrived in Spain. And he also mentions him at the beginning to Homage to Catalonia, and he had a really big impact on Orwell. And here he is kind of talking about him and fascists and hierarchy, classless utopias, and all that sort of stuff.
The other memory is of the Italian militiaman who shook my hand in the guardroom the day I joined the militia. I wrote about this man at the beginning of my book on the Spanish War, Homage to Catalonia, and do not want to repeat what I said there. When I remember... Oh, how vividly his shabby uniform and fierce, pathetic, innocent face. The complex side issues of the war seem to fade away, and I see clearly that there was at any rate no doubt as to who was in the right. In spite of power politics and journalistic lying, the central issue of the war was the attempt of people like this to win the decent life, which they knew to be their birthright. It is difficult to think of this particular man's probable end without several kinds of bitterness. Since I met him in the Lenin barracks, he was probably a Trotskyist or an anarchist. And in the peculiar conditions of our time, when people of that sort are not killed by the Gestapo, they are usually killed by the GPU. But that does not affect the long-term issues. This man's face, which I saw only for a minute or two, remains with me as a sort of visual reminder of what the war was really about. He symbolizes for me the flower of the European working class, harried by the police of all countries, the people who fill the mass graves of the Spanish battlefields and are now, to the tune of several millions, rotting in forced labor camps. When one thinks of all the people who support or have supported fascism, one stands amazed at their diversity. What a crew! Think of a program which, at any rate for a while, could bring Hitler, Pétain, Montagu Norman, Pavlich, William Randolph Hearst, Stryker, Buchman, Ezra Pound, Juan March, Cocteau, Tyson, Father Coughlin, the Mufti of Jerusalem, Arnold Lunn, Antonescu, Spengler, Beverly Nichols, Lady Houston, and Marinetti all into the same boat. But the clue is really very simple. They're all people with something to lose, or people who long for a hierarchical society and dread the prospect of a world of free and equal human beings. Behind all the ballyhoo that is talked about godless Russia and the materialism of the working class lies the simple intention of those with money or privileges to cling to them. Ditto, though it contains a partial truth, with all the talk about the worthlessness of social reconstruction not accompanied by a change of heart. The pious ones, from the Pope to the yogis of California, are great on the change of heart, much more reassuring from their point of view than a change in the economic system.
That part amazes me.
Yeah.
Because who were the yogis of California at that time?
In the 40s, like, it seems way too early.
It seems
like,
way too early.
He's, like, referencing kind of, like the Eastern meditation, like, New Ageism.
Right.
But that's, in common parlance, that's thought of at least 20 years after what he's writing.
And if it is around, it doesn't seem like it's localized to California at that
point. Yeah, it, like, can't possibly be a popular notion.
Well, because, like, T.S. Eliot, you know, does a lot of that sort of stuff. And
yeah.
He has a lot of those Eastern influences. And,
yeah, but it's always for the greater good of the Anglican Church.
Right, and I'm sure Ezra Pound had similar sort of motives and things like that. Like they, that stuff was influential, but to localize it as the yogis of California is just like fucking hilarious.
To do a deep dive on that.
Yeah, I wonder who he's thinking of. If there was some book, I don't know.
With all the talk about the worthlessness of social reconstruction not accompanied by a change of heart. The pious ones, from the Pope to the yogis of California, are great on the change of heart. Much more reassuring from their point of view than a change in the economic system. Pétain attributes the fall of France to the common people's love of pleasure. One sees this in its right perspective if one stops to wonder how much pleasure the ordinary French peasant's or working man's life would contain compared with Pétain's own. The damned impertinence of these politicians, priests, literary men, and whatnot, who lecture the working-class socialist for his materialism. All that the working man demands is what these others would consider the indispensable minimum without which human life cannot be lived at all. Enough to eat, freedom from the haunting terror of unemployment, the knowledge that your children will get a fair chance, a bath once a day, clean linen reasonably often, a roof that doesn't leak, and short enough working hours to leave you with a little energy when the day is done. Not one of those who preach against materialism would consider life livable without these things. Mm-hmm. And how easily that minimum could be obtained if we chose to set our minds to it for only 20 years. To raise the standards of living of the whole world to that of Britain would not be a greater undertaking than the war we have just fought.
Mm.
I don't claim, and I don't know who does.
It's like AOC using war metaphors for the Green New Deal.
Yeah, exactly.
Obtained if we chose to set our minds to it for only 20 years. To raise the standards of living of the whole world to that of Britain would not be a greater undertaking than the war we have just fought. I don't claim, and I don't know who does, that that would solve anything in itself. It is merely that privation and brute labour have to be abolished before the real problems of humanity can be tackled. The major problem of our time is the decay of the belief in personal immortality, and it cannot be dealt with while the average human being is either drudging like an ox or shivering in fear of the secret police. How right the working classes are in their materialism. How right they are to realize that the belly comes before the soul, not in the scale of values, but in point of time. Understand that, and the long horror that we are enduring becomes at least intelligible. All the considerations that are likely to make one falter, the siren voices of a Pétain or of a Gandhi, the inescapable fact that in order to fight one has to degrade oneself, the equivocal moral position of Britain, with its democratic phrases and its coolie empire, the sinister development of Soviet Russia, the squalid farce of left-wing politics. All this fades away, and one sees only the struggle of the gradually awakening common people against the lords of property and their hired liars and bumsuckers. The question is very simple. Shall...
Sorry, I just want to replay that line, because it's my favorite in the essay.
The siren voices of a Pétain or of a Gandhi. The inescapable fact that in order to fight one has to degrade oneself. The equivocal moral position of Britain, with its democratic phrases and its coolie empire. The sinister development of Soviet Russia. The squalid farce of left-wing politics. All this fades away, and one sees only the struggle of the gradually awakening common people against the lords of property and their hired liars and bumsuckers. The question is very simple. Shall people like that Italian soldier be allowed to live the decent, fully human life which is now technically achievable? Or shan't they? Shall the common man be pushed back into the mud, or shall he not? I myself believe, perhaps on insufficient grounds, that the common man will win his fight sooner or later. But I want it to be sooner and not later, sometime within the next 100 years, say, and not sometime within the next 10,000 years. That was the real issue of the Spanish War, and of the last war, and perhaps of other wars yet to come.
He's the GOAT. I love Orwell.
Yeah.
Just crushes it there. Like, as a statement of socialistic values.
Yeah.
Like, and what matters.
Yeah.
Like, that is, you can't really beat that.
Well, it's a way of just winnowing away the complexity that we, the cobwebs that we talked about earlier, where it's, you can't ever nail down a fact, because the details of modern life are constantly shifting based mm-hmm. on who you ask and who's going to tell you what. And Orwell is saying, like, this is the struggle. And the struggle is, it's always going to be a different configuration of this essential problem.
Yeah, that's the most important part of Orwell in the Spanish Civil War to me, is that he didn't come away from it disillusioned. He I think it's in Homage to Catalonia, he talks about, like, despite all this, I come away, like, struggling with actual regular people, you know, regardless of what was happening in the corridors of power to, like, you know, subvert them. Mm-hmm. The genuine effort given by comrades he was with, basically made him not optimistic, but that's the wrong word to use with Orwell, but sort of like a sort of a happy warrior sort of thing.
Clarifying almost that there's something emboldening about, like, the beginning of wisdom is being able to define, call things by their proper name. Mm-hmm. And once that, like, once you get that configuration or that key in your head, the struggle becomes much more straightforward.
Right. And he also does something that I think the left needs to learn, or part of the left needs to learn about. I mean, it circles back to the, there's no such thing as a war where it doesn't matter who wins.
Yeah.
Like, you can't let your desire for liberation be turned off because politicians are doing politics. Like, they will always suck. They'll always fuck you. They might literally lead to, like, killing fields. But you have to be, but that can't, like, make you, sort of feel that all sides are the same and this is all just, let's just retreat to nihilism.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about this essay so much. So if you enjoyed this, you'll want to probably become a patron, I would imagine, at patreon.com.
Unless you're some sort of fool.
Yeah, / literary hangover, because we're going to be going through a lot of Orwell essays. We're going to basically... I want literary hangover to sort of colonize Orwell's. You know, there's a lot of... We talked about Henry James writing the Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Somewhere in England, Grace's ears are perking
up.
Yeah.
Well, Literary Hangover is going to develop a presence around George Orwell.
Okay.
I mean, Hitchens did that too. Hitchens did that with a lot of people, particularly Orwell.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need stewards of certain people's reputations, and I There's no writer who I've read more at this point than George Orwell. Like I just finished his 50 essays, the collection, this past week, and I'm like, is that all? That's all there is? Like, I have more? I was reading the Michael Sheldon, listening to the Michael Sheldon biography, and I wish that was like 30 hours as opposed to 15. Like,
yeah.
I can't get enough of this guy. So I hope listeners, you enjoyed this as well. Alex, do you have anything else you want to add?
No, I just think that in a time where the unfortunate part of being part of the canon and the way that Orwell is with 1984 and Animal Farm is your ideas are used by every reactionary piece of shit.
Right. Anti-revolution.
We're not just talking fascists here. We're talking like capitalist fascists like Apple. Like, it's absurd to think that 1984 is synonymous with someone like Steve Jobs.
Yes.
It's disgusting, actually. It's gross. And so, like, the idea that we could assert a more genuine portrait of Orwell is always necessary.
And now that you mention that, I just want to bring up a quote from Orwell that might surprise people a little bit. And I'd be curious if this is in your collection here. If it is, I'm going to buy that definitely, like, immediately. But Orwell's reviewing a book here. This is from a good book on Orwell called... it's by Philip Bounds, Orwell and Marxism, The Political and Cultural Thinking of George Orwell by Philip Bounds. Here is a quote. Here's one in 1939. This is from a review of The Clue of History by John McMurray. This is George Orwell saying, "I personally would agree with Professor McMurray that humanity must move in the direction of communism or perish." That's an Orwell quote you wouldn't have expected.
Yeah.
Here's another one. This is from an essay called The Frontiers of Art and Propaganda in 1941. He says, "The most lively criticism of the last 10 years has nearly all of it been the work of Marxist writers, people like Christopher Caldwell and Philip Henderson and Edward Upward, who look on every book virtually as a political pamphlet and are far more interested in digging out its political and social implications than its literary qualities in the narrow sense." And that's also what Literary Hangover is looking to do. So I would like to think that Orwell would appreciate Literary Hangover. And if, like I said, if you do, patreon.com/literaryhangover, I want to get to 200 patrons in the next few months. We're about 40 away, so we can get there. Alex, thank you once again.
Yeah.
And we will see you the next time we release one of these boys, I guess.